Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Real life is scarier than anything we can dream of. And we dream such frightening things. Sci-fi and Scream.
Be afraid.
Be very afraid on Joy 94.9.
And welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream with Sonia.
And Kaz.
There we go. Excellent. Now, that was Sam Sparrow.
Yes, and that was his track Black and Gold, which was quite popular a couple of years ago. Still is a good track. And we chose that one because tonight we're talking about religion and science fiction. And Sam Sparrow, I believe, is actually a Christian, and he wrote that song about God and the meaning that God, the existence of God, gives his life. So when he's talking about, you know, if you're not really there in the stars, then the stars don't even matter, he's referring to God, which I sort of, when I found out, I thought that was quite an interesting
inspiration sort of
thing for a pop song to take.
Yeah. And just thanks to David and Jade for Different Strokes. Another great hour of those folks. And yeah, so tonight we're looking at religion, spirituality, I suppose, and its role in science fiction.
Absolutely. And we're going to talk a little bit about the different functions that religion has played in some very popular science fiction output, like 2001 A Space Odyssey, Dune, Philip Pullman's Dark Materials, Battlestar Galactica, the new series, and even the old series, because Glenn A. Larson, of course, was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the Mormons.
Hmm.
So there's quite a connection there. We'll also be playing a little bit of music that's related to at least religion, if not science fiction.
Kind of related, yes.
Kind of related.
Yeah. Well, to begin with, let's have a look at 2001 A Space Odyssey. We have briefly mentioned this iconic piece a couple of times, I believe, in the past shows that we've been doing. Now, of course, it was written by Arthur C. Clarke, and he wrote it actually pretty much after the film was due to be released.
It was 1968. Kind of written in tandem with Kubrick,
Stanley Kubrick, the director. Now, Clark's first venture into film was with Stanley Kubrick, who directed 2001 A Space Odyssey. And Kubrick and Clark had met in New York City in 1964 in discussions to do a collaboration on a film project. This was the idea that was developed, and it was decided that the story for the film was to be loosely based on one of Clark's early short stories called The Sentinel, which he wrote back in 1948. Now, that was a BBC short story. Apparently it was for them. Originally, Clark was going to write the screenplay for the film, but Kubrick suggested during one of their brainstorming meetings that before the actual beginning of the actual script, they should let their imagination soar free by writing a novel first, which the film would then be based upon. But after so many delays with the filming, it wasn't actually released until the spring of 1968, the film. So the book was... the book was done afterwards, and the book was credited just to Arthur C. Clarke alone, which was interesting. I wasn't aware of that. Did you know that?
I did know. And in a lot of the versions of publications of 2001, there's actually a preface which explains what the novel underwent with Clarke and Kubrick. And I really think that it's probably, going on the history, it's fair enough that it's just attributed to Clarke. While Kubrick sort of contributed some ideas, it sort of ends up going in a different direction. And, of course, Clarke then wrote the sequels to that story.
Sequels which maybe one day would be made into a film, but I don't think there's any plans to do that yet.
No, not as far as I know, but they're very
big subject.
Very rich books, so there's a lot to take out of there.
And of course, for people who don't know what 2001 is all about, the background to the story in the book is of an ancient and unseen alien race, although we never see them as a race, that use a mechanism that appears to be like a large crystalline monolith or a giant slab of, well, it looks like black graphite, but we're not really sure what it is because it's so smooth and this precision
of it. It absorbs all light, I think he says in the novel. So it's not a reflective thing. It's a real mysterious kind of substance.
And it's this perfect you know, shape, this perfect monolith shape. And apparently it investigates all the galaxies and it goes out to encourage and develop intelligent life. Now, the book begins with one such monolith, as does the film, appearing in ancient Africa about 3 or 4 million years BC. It inspires a starving group of hominid ancestors of human beings to conceive of tools, and of course they move on to killing animals and then killing each other. So it's got that sort of element of he's trying to find where is the spark of that creative spark and where does it come to?
Yeah.
In early man, I guess.
It's a little more, it's not explained in much more detail in the novel. It's still pretty basic. But it's just about, yeah, what sort of, how did we start to interact with other groups of humans? Where did that lead? Obviously, the line they're taking is that it's quite a violent.
Yes.
Sort of birth.
I mean, it is a beautiful shot. We'll always remember that edited shot of the bone that's been used to thrash one of the enemy hominid
flying
tribes
in
flying into the air, do the close-up of the editing, and then suddenly it's a spaceship above the Earth going towards the moon. And it's one of the most amazing science fiction shots, I think.
It's an incredible shot, and it's interesting because you go from this idea of it's essentially evolution. It's not sort of the biological evolution. It's really just more of the progression of human beings. But then you sort of move into, as you said, these unknown beings, which are, take on a godlike status
in
the film
unseen.
And in the novel. Well, they're unseen. That's part of their kind of omnipresence. They're unseen, but they have a hand in how these, you know, how the humans develop. And they make it explicit to Dave in towards the end of the film, and in especially in the book, there's a lot of detail about kind of what their purpose is, what their plan is for him.
It's very mysterious, perhaps more mysterious in the film, I think.
The book's probably a bit more
in detail,
makes more sense,
but the film doesn't. And I know that people criticize it for that, but personally, that's the one thing that totally intrigued me and has always stayed with me, is the fact that it is such a mysterious, obtuse, obscure definition of life, basically, and death. I mean, I think it's got one of the greatest, I presume he's died.
Dave
Bowman, the original astronaut. We don't know.
He's kind of
somewhere else altogether.
Yeah, he's kind of reborn almost. And you get this star child at the end.
Yeah.
Who is this, you know.
It's pretty way out.
Who really knows what it means.
It is way out.
And the thing about 2001 A Space Odyssey is that in itself, viewing the film was seen by some as a particularly religious experience. So you had people, you know, when they came out of it, saying that it sort of filled, you know, a hole in their lives. They had these ideas about philosophy and science and physics, and 2001 actually kind of gave them this filled this godless gap. Some people wrote to Kubrick and said that with 2001, you may have quite possibly saved any number of spiritual and physical lives. You know, people were like born again Christians with this film.
Yeah, which probably have led to some pretty strange New Age remnants. But his position on religion is quite interesting, Arthur C. Clarke, because he was friends with Alan Watts. And Alan Watts was a British philosopher and writer and speaker, but he was probably the man who singularly made popular Eastern philosophy for a Western audience. And Zen Buddhism certainly does come up quite strongly in just the whole thematic sense, I think, of his stories, in particular 2001. It's like a meditation, I think, on what is creation.
Absolutely. And I think you don't need to take it quite literally.
And he was, he considered himself an atheist.
He was atheist, agnostic.
He said in 2000, he said, "I don't believe in God or an afterlife." He said that in a Sri Lankan newspaper because he lived there, of course. He was an honorary Sri Lankan for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
But he insisted that if he was going to be, you know, pigeonholed, he would say Buddhism was something that he would describe himself as, a crypto-Buddhist, because he insisted right until the end that Buddhism was not actually a religion. So he had very little interest in his earlier incarnation, I suppose, as a Presbyterian. He was brought up like a Presbyterian. And he was also very influenced by a scientist called J.B.S. Haldane, who's a British-born geneticist and evolutionary biologist. And he was very famous for developing mathematical theories in population genetics, which is, you know, pretty much what people study today, migration as part of evolution and genetics as well. And he was the guy who is believed to have quoted to have said, my own suspicion is that the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, but queerer than we can suppose. And of course, I think Richard Dawkins used that quite recently.
I'm sure he would have.
He would have liked that.
He would have liked that quote, definitely.
So that's Arthur C. Clarke's 2001, and just a little bit about Arthur C. Clarke. So I always find it interesting that it's a very, what would you say, it's a very spiritual type of film.
It is a spiritual type of film, but I mean, to be honest.
It's got a lot of philosophical, I suppose, meditations in there as well.
It does. I didn't see it, to be honest. I didn't see it as a particularly spiritual film until I started doing research for this show, because I'd never ever seen it that way. If anything, I kind of saw the final section of that film as maybe relating to hallucinogenic drugs.
Oh, really?
Okay. Oh, absolutely. I saw it more as a response to the LSD
of the times.
Culture of the time. So it's interesting. We're talking about 2001, A Space Odyssey, because we're talking about religion in science fiction tonight.
Sci-fi and Scream, and that was a piece of music called The Magisterium, and that's from the Golden Compass soundtrack for the film, music by Alexandre Desplat. I hope I've said that correctly. My Fonse is not... Très bien, not good. Bien.
No, I know. I don't think that's right either.
Oh.
So obviously Philip Pullman wrote the books, his Dark Materials series, that The Golden Compass was based on. The first book was actually called The Northern Lights, or Northern Lights, in the UK and Australia and around the world, except I believe in the US, where it was called The Golden Compass, refers to the alethiometer.
Why wouldn't they follow?
It's kind of like why they called it Sorcerer's Stone and not Philosopher's Stone, Harry Potter, in the US.
Oh, because I don't know what the word philosopher means.
I don't want to cast aspersions on
our cousins
in the US.
Yeah.
But his Dark Materials, you've read all the books, Sonia?
Yes, I have. And I've always meant to take the time out or be, you know, maybe unemployed. Hopefully not. That will happen. Hopefully not. And read them again and again because, just blown away by them.
They're an incredible series of books. For anyone who hasn't read them, it basically follows the story of a young girl, Lyra, from Oxford, and she is swept up in through her uncle and various players, including the Magisterium, which is... what that track referred to, which is the Magisterium, is basically like the church or the high church in the world that Lyra lives in, and it's a modern, not a modern day, but it's kind of a speculative take on the Milton poem. So it's really quite an interesting series of books, and it's obviously it was turned into a film as well, The Golden Compass, which probably didn't do as well and wasn't as well executed as you would want. However, the books themselves came under a fair degree of controversy when they were released and when people actually read them. So as is always the way the books came out, somebody noticed that they had particularly religious content in them.
Strong-looking Catholic symbolisms. And
lots of symbolism.
Or even could be high Anglican. Virtually.
Well, it is. And I mean, because it is based on Paradise Lost, the Milton poem, it has a lot of huge reference because he is literally taking characters from Paradise Lost and putting them into the world of his Dark Materials. So it has very strong religious content. However, he takes a slightly different bent to Milton in the sense that I wouldn't even say that he says that pulling away from the church or this godlike figure is a good thing. It just happens to be what his characters do. They basically bring down the idea of God because in the books God is an angel rather than sort of this high being. He just happens to be kind of the first angel and the
highest. Which is fantastic in the last book. This is a spoiler, but when you see exactly the decrepit creature that God is, this wizened, shriveled person-like thing.
Yeah, it's
just remarkable.
But the thing is, the point, I suppose, that the poem makes indirectly and that the books make quite explicitly is that this idea of a god and then having these factions that fight over what is right, what is wrong, who has the power, who doesn't have the power.
Who has control over people.
Absolutely.
Children in particular are used like pawns, and who has control over the spirit animals that they have.
That's right.
Their connection to that.
People have like kind of their souls or their counterpoints, which exist outside their bodies, and they're referred to as demons. They in the form of an animal, which is just, you know, another fascinating sort of part of the books. But it really is, as you sort of said, Sonia, that you get to the end of the books and God is just nothing. He's this. He's a fading. He's held together,
worn
basically.
Out,
yeah.
Old, decrepit man.
That's right.
Just there's nothing really, there's no power or sense of power there, and it's like this facade with all these boisterous, nasty angels trying to block people from seeing the truth.
But the thing is that the war and the battle that comes
it's extraordinary.
Of, you know,
that is so graphic and, you know, extraordinary. I think I just had to put it down and go for a wander. First time I had a look at that.
Yeah, so I mean, Pullman himself is an atheist, and I think he's quite unashamed about it. But he really sort of just creates a world where people are affected by ideas of God, religion, what is right, what is ordained, and they do horrible things because of it.
Because of the control of information.
Well, control of information
might hurt people, but it's best that people get hurt sometimes.
But also faith and sin and protection. So you have this, you know, one of the characters is basically trying to stop the Adam and Eve scenario from repeating itself. So you have within the books this idea of original sin that just, you know, it's suggested that it just keeps perpetuating in each generation.
But so, it always perpetuates. I mean,
well,
that's the thing. It's human nature. And it's interesting that he, you know, that's an interesting point, because these two people are thrown together, and yet at the same time there are forces of a darkness that are trying to make sure they don't get together.
Yeah, so essentially these two characters, the Adam and Eve character, Lyra and Will.
Two different worlds.
They are literally from two different worlds. And
literally different dimensions.
You know, and their love or their relationship and their natural, very natural affection for each other is kind of thwarted and compromised by this this religious zeal and the effects of these, you know, this sort of activities of the high church and the angels and all of these sorts of things. And what Pullman does is he boils it down to a boy and a girl who are blooming into adolescence, and
that's the biggest fear.
That's the fear. The fear that
biggest
they're
fear.
Reaching
and
sexual
they're still
maturity.
Having this fear, which is, you know, played out in several organisations outside of these books.
Well, that's the other
thing.
The
biggest fear is that, and the control that adults have over that is something that I think turns off most or the largest percentage of people on the planet when it comes to organised religion in any case.
Well, that's it. When you shine the spotlight outside of the books,
you see,
you see where he's kind of pulling his ideas from.
The light's fallen. Oh, look, there's an SMS. Who's that from?
Okay, we've got an SMS from Gracie Liu, and she has mentioned religion plays a big part in sci-fi. Stranger in a Strange Land by Heinlein is an example of a messianic theme. Sci-fi is frequently about questioning beliefs. And I would agree. Heinlein, Stranger in a Strange Land is a very sort of big example of religion in science fiction. And Heinlein, I think, started out maybe Presbyterian or something and then kind of moved towards agnosticism.
And what's interesting about these writers is a lot of them, the ones that I managed to do research on, they all experienced a very fraught, difficult period in life, which was called the Second World War, and a lot of them survived that, and I think it did affect them very much so, especially with the geopolitical stuff that comes through in speculative and science fiction writing.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't live through something like that without questioning.
I mean, Tolkien lived through, for example, bit of a leap, sorry, but Tolkien lived through the First World War, and
he
that's
did.
So obvious in the writing.
Oh, absolutely. And you just have to read the scenes in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Towards the devastation of the king. Yeah, absolutely. So we're talking about religion on Sci-Fi and Squeam tonight, and religion's role in science fiction in particular. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam with Kaz and Sonia, and we're looking at spirituality or God in the mix when it comes to sci-fi writing and science fiction film, but also television.
Yes, we're going to talk a little bit about a show that we've mentioned before on Sci-Fi and Squeam, but we're looking at it from a religious perspective tonight, and that is Supernatural. Now, the show is about the Winchester brothers, Dean and Sam, who travel across the US fighting sort of these supernatural forces of evil, hence the show's name. Now, the show itself draws on a combination of sort of Christian and pagan mythological, classical mythological archetypes and symbols. So there's a big mix in there. The first season, which I'm most familiar with, emphasises New Age methods of sort of a fighting creatures, you know, like demons and I suppose like evil fairies, so mischief makers and that sort of thing. And that's very pagan influenced. But as the show progresses, and I suppose even in the first season, Christian themes in particular, kind of more Catholic, I suppose we would call them, ideas become more dominant. And I mean, I don't know if you would agree with this, Sonia, but it might, do you think it's just tied into the dominance of Christianity in America, in the American population?
Yes, it does feel a bit like that. It feels like there's two different types of American viewers, perhaps. There's the True Blood viewers, but that's obviously horror, whereas this is more sort of, I guess, modern fantasy, not so much sci-fi, I suppose.
No.
And dealing more perhaps with the coping mechanisms of perhaps fundamentalists, Catholics or Christians.
Well, it's interesting because I think the show is written or at least showrun by someone of a Jewish background.
Oh.
So I don't think anyone on the production team is particularly...
It's an in-joke, maybe.
It might be. But it also may be that there's a lot of this in Catholic mythology and Catholic stories in the Catholic religion.
Because it's so pagan. It's incredibly pagan.
Well, there are those obviously very deep historical links to paganism. And you're looking at things like certain types of angels, so the different orders of angels, which is something I didn't claim
Eros
to be familiar
and Psyche,
with.
I mean, they're Greek and Roman, and they were borrowed. We've got plenty of saints that have been desanctitized. I don't know what it's called, but they've been demoted. Like, I believe St. Christopher's no longer a saint because he was actually pagan.
Oh, right.
Pre-Catholic. So people like that are out of favor.
I mean, this is the thing. It sort of ties in a lot of these ideas that, I mean, we're talking about Christianity being particularly mainstream in America. However, from what I've seen of Supernatural, and admittedly I haven't seen all of the series, I've only seen sort of one and two extensively, I don't think if I was a fundamentalist Christian, I don't actually know that I would agree with or watch this show.
You'd be watching Charmed instead?
Well, no, because I think that you'll find, as with that Republican Senate candidate or whoever she was who got in trouble for dabbling in witchcraft when she was in high school.
No,
the one who looks like Palin. Fundamentalist Christians tend to stay well away from it.
Mm. Because they just wrestling snakes and things like that.
I don't know if they quite Pentecostals quite fall into it, but they've had an episode in Supernatural where there was a healer, spiritual faith healer, who was actually was his wife, spoiler alert, who was kind of channeling this Reaper character who would actually take life from another person and restore the one who wanted to be healed. Mm. So what they did was they took a traditional... Well, maybe not a traditional, but a very banal sort of Christian idea of faith healing and turned it around so that it actually turned out to be one of these reapers who was working under the guise of a religious idea.
Which, so mythological. I mean, that's similar to some Greek myths, and it's borrowing heavily on the pantheon of those ancient European type of myths and Middle Eastern myths.
Well, as you said, it also... relates to that idea.
Astarte and people like that.
All of those things. But it also relates to that idea that you mentioned of religion and religious ideas as a coping mechanism. So the idea that you would go to a preacher or a person who said they could heal you through prayer, I mean, you know, if you're going to be skeptical about it, it's not going to happen. However, what they've done is they've said, yeah, it works in this instance because there is a supernatural force. It's not God or a demon. It's a malevolent kind of reaper. So they've really kind of taken that idea, which is a fundamentally a good sort of Christian positive healing idea, and turned it on its head, which is quite interesting.
Now I was looking up a bit about the show Supernatural. Now, what I did come up with, I don't know if this episode's shown, but apparently there is a lot of hints that there'll actually be a meeting of people will meet God in one of the seasons coming up. Is that?
I don't know if it's happened yet. I know that this is, again, you know, anyone who wants to correct us on our supernatural knowledge out there. I know that they've met the archangels or some of the archangels in the show. I don't know how close they are to meeting God. I know Dean and I think Sam as well have been to hell now.
Right.
So who knows if they're going to make it in the opposite direction. But I mean,
it's interesting. Yeah,
it is. It's an interesting show in the sense that what it's done is it's brought sort of the occult into the mainstream without making it seem threatening. So they've kind of brought it in, like I said, that mix of pagan and Christianity. Mm. So they're using it as a way to fight demons. It's kind of playful, even in that sense. So you've got these two characters who are like demon hunters.
It certainly sounds more intelligent than perhaps a lot of the fodder that's out there, like, what was it, Flash Forward
and Fringe. I don't think I've ever
heard
the word intelligent applied to Supernatural, but well, I'm sure it has
been. It sounds a lot more. It sounds like they're doing some interesting research.
It's definitely, from a classicist and you know, literature point of view, it's definitely more intertextual. Like, they've brought a lot of things in from different myths, a lot of the little malevolent sort of supernatural beings are from different stories. You've almost got, like, in one episode, a
fairy
Loki.
Tales.
Yeah, or a Loki-style character from Nordic myth.
Yeah.
So they've really put quite an interesting mix in there.
A bit of work in there.
And sort of slipped it in, I thought. I think they've kind of slipped it in under the radar, quite frankly. I think some people can look at this and go, yeah, it's good versus evil. Other people can look at it and go, it's about what people believe. And they believe, you know, this idea of sort of Christian or Catholic ideas, but there's actually something else at play.
It's a little bit like The Name of the Rose. It sounds like they're almost like two monks on a mission. And that's often in some particularly Catholic stories. There are stories of monks going through all the different, almost like Dante's, you know, different
Inferno,
different rings, different levels. But they're not monks, I take it.
No, they don't live a monk's life. They don't live a monkish lifestyle
at all.
If anything, kind of the opposite. There's a lot of drinking and you know, womanizing. And
it's a clever show. It sounds like it's quite a clever show. Like, it's obviously incorporating all the stuff that's going to hook people in. A lot of females would watch it, and maybe some guys would like to be those guys.
Yeah, I'm sure they would.
I'm
sure a lot of guys
would like
to be with those guys as well.
Right.
So that's Supernatural, and I've had another message come through, another one from Gracie, who's saying that God, that would be Dean, right? Because if you haven't seen the show, Sonia, Dean thinks quite highly of himself.
He really
does see himself as quite a an elevated figure and a bit of a ladies' man as well. He provides the comic relief in the show. And yeah, just fantastic. So Glenn has also SMS'd in. Hi, Glenn. Stargate SG-1 is full of religious storylines. It almost takes an atheist superhero ideal with the Stargate team, having to prove to the natives that they are enslaved by false gods and helping them fight back against what they have been taught to believe their whole lives. So thanks for that, Glenn.
Okay.
We're probably going to talk a little bit about, not much, but a little bit about the Ori's storyline from Stargate.
Oh, yes, right.
Which was really interesting. Something they kind of included really late in the series, but it was fascinating. But something else I wanted to mention as well was Battlestar Galactica. You kind of can't talk about religious TV or science fiction television lately in the last few years and religion without mentioning Battlestar Galactica. Now, unbeknownst to many people, Battlestar Galactica has kind of been steeped in religion almost since its origins. The producer, Glenn A. Larson, of the original series was influenced by the Book of Mormon, I suppose.
It's about Jonathan Smith, isn't it?
About Joseph Smith.
Oh, sorry, Joseph.
Got to get your Mormon
Tabernacles,
right?
Yeah.
He was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Glenn A. Larson. And I think people have made the connection between the Book of Mormon and Battlestar Galactica. So in the new series or the reimagined series, you have these, they really, really push that. They push religion in Battlestar Galactica, the new series. It's the core of the stories and of the themes. So you have these significant sort of seven Cylons that follow a monotheistic religion that's been handed down to them from the final five. So you're getting into a lot of the deeper story here in Battlestar Galactica. But basically you have the monotheist Cylons versus the polytheist humans, so the members of the colonies. It's really interesting because it's something they're exploring a lot more in Caprica, which is the prequel show for Battlestar Galactica. It's something they explored through having certain characters represent almost an angel or demon kind of idea. So you had Kara Thrace or Starbuck, who took on almost, I mean, I never really quite figured out what she was supposed to be, really, if she was sort of this harbinger of death or if she was an angel.
She's a woman.
She's a woman.
There
so
you go.
She's a, you know,
that's all
must
you need
be
to
harbinger
say.
Of death. And then, of course, you have sort of Gaius and Six as these, we don't know if they're angels or demons or really what Gaius's purpose is. It introduced quite heavy religious ideas. And
why do you think they're doing this? Is it because they're short of story ideas or trying to appease fans that maybe haven't gone over to the other side of becoming, I don't know, atheists or it's some remnant?
Well, no, I mean, I wouldn't say that there's a particular agenda. I actually think it's probably, maybe it was quite an organic thing. Because I haven't seen a lot of the early series, the original series of Battlestar Galactica, I don't know how prevalent religion was.
It wasn't.
Yeah, I didn't think
it was.
It was
more about Richard Hatch and Dirk Benedict's blow-wave hairdos. I mean, seriously.
Well, there is something religious and you know,
about
highly spiritual
blow
about
wave.
A blow wave. So, I mean, I really don't know. And this is something that I think is fascinating to explore and needs sort of more time than we can deserve to give it. But Battlestar Galactica definitely has to stand out as one of the thematically religious, the most important religious texts of the last few years in terms of science fiction.
There's another SMS. Love you guys. Thanks for the interesting discussion. How about Religion of Caprica? You did mention that.
Yeah,
so next
Caprica, Caprica is back next month, which is very exciting. And look, they have they really look at the origins of the monotheistic religion that the Cylons follow.
Mm.
So you've got the Soldiers of the One. It looks at kind of terrorism related to religion. Really fascinating backstory in Caprica. So if you enjoyed Battlestar Galactica and particularly the religious elements, be sure to try and get.
Do you think that's why there's such
a glimpse of Caprica
resurgence in this idea, or the idea of so much more religion in sci-fi television in particular?
The influence of Battlestar Galactica?
Yeah, because of terrorism.
Well, actually, I think you're probably on the right track there. I think since 2001 and the attacks on the World Trade Center, I think it has. I think whether you can track the change or define the change is another thing, but I think that it's definitely affected television. Even when you mentioned flash forward earlier, you're looking at something with religious connotation, but something that, you know, it's religious, but there's a big trail of disaster that follows it.
There's some sort of cultural explosion happened.
And physical explosions. Mm. We're talking about religion on Sci-Fi and Scream tonight.
Sci-Fi and Scream with Sonia and Kaz, and we're looking at spirituality or God, the Godhead. What is that crazy thing out there, apparently, that controls us?
And just to break it up a little bit, we played Thoughts of a Dying Atheist by Muse.
Mm. And now I'm going to look quickly at Dune. Now, Dune is a science fiction novel, for those who don't know, written by, of course, Frank Herbert, published in 1965. And won the Hugo Award in 1966. It also won the Nebula Award for Best Novel at the same time. It's often cited as the world's best-selling science fiction novel and perhaps one of the most influential when it comes to the topic about, well, God, Jesus, messianic stuff, Buddhism, intergalactic politics, PSI powers, and the functions of an alien ecosystem. And it's also a bit of a space opera, because it deals with a family and their trials and tribulations. So it's got that feudalism too. Do you know, have you read the books?
No, I have to, I've seen the film, but apparently that only deals with like the first 15 pages or
15 minutes.
Yeah, so I do have to read the book. It's actually really hard to get a copy of Dune.
Yeah.
Of just Dune, and not one of the...
Well, if you want an original edition that was published in 1965, they're now worth US $10,000 each.
Yeah, that's not happening.
Now, in Dune, Herbert plunged into an alien future that centred around a complex interplanetary civilization. His idea was to, well, it was, you know, he started thinking about it in the 1950s when he was studying governmental ecological projects designed to halt the spread of sand dunes in Oregon, where he was studying. Now, he sort of incorporated that into not just a eco sort of idea of what happens when humanity basically starts to take a little bit too much of a resource and the resources start to run out. And he incorporates that with a feudal sort of idea and the spreading of human civilization into outer space, because they're looking for a new place to live and a new place to take advantage of things. But when we start off with Dune, what's happening there is they are going into looking at the spice, which is an interesting place, an interesting product that's made from something called melange, which is made from sandworms on the planet Arrakis. Now, it starts with the Imperial House of Carino, and Dune tells the story of a young Paul Atreides, who's an heir apparent to the House of Atreides, as his and his family accept control of the desert planet Arrakis, where this most sought-after resource called spices. Most importantly, this valuable substance is something that helps create time folding. So it's a very multi-layered concept, I suppose, series of books. And it just explores the whole complex interactions of politics, religion, ecology and technology, mixed in with human emotions and a bit of, Jesus sort of identity as well. Now, his idea of what a superhuman was, according to Frank Herbert, was he wanted to show a supernatural, superhuman superhero, but he wanted to make it look like any person could become a superhero and do it slowly. Now, the young Paul Atreides slowly becomes this messianic figurehead through taking the spice, or taking the melange, or the water of life that's made from the worms, and being exposed to the dust on the planet Arrakis. When he arrives, he starts to have these visions, and these visions basically tell him he must become a leader of the people who are living on the planet, who are like Bedouins or freemen, they're called. Yeah. So yeah, it's a slow and painful personal growth that he has. And I guess that's why it goes out over so many books. And there are a number of the books. I haven't read all of them, so I do apologise. But there's Dune, Messiah, which is the first one, actually. Children of Dune, God Emperor of Dune, Heretics of Dune, and Chapter House Dune. And, of course, in 1984, there was the film adaptation by David Lynch. And in 2000, the Sci-Fi Channel had a miniseries called Dune, with a sequel made in 2003. There's been computer games, board games, and at the moment there's still books being written, co-written by the author's own son, Brian Herbert, with Kevin J. Anderson. They began writing those books in 1999. So it's an incredible series of books, and it looks, you know, deeply at religion, and it also does what I think he calls it syncretic religious ideas. He takes everything from Jungian psychology to Zen, mixes it with Mahayana Buddhism, even Shia Islam, Sufism, which is obviously a hybrid and offspring of Islamic mysticism. He even uses South American religious ideas and puts them into this gigantic melting pot, which is the series of Dune. So I think it's been incredibly influential.
I would say that it has. I think it's probably influenced, I mean, like you said, it's kind of this melting pot of different religious ideas. And I think that that's something that science fiction has become known for, and if whether or not it started with June. I'm sure it actually started a little earlier. But, you know, it's interesting, we had one of the listeners message in about Stargate. Stargate is a melting pot of different religions. I mean, essentially you start off with the Egyptian gods, the older religion of Egypt, the high religion of Egypt. So you've got Ra and you have all these ideas, and that all came from the film, the Stargate film. But then you kind of go into the TV series and you see that you have these creatures called the Ghoul, which they are either sort of posed as the gods of Egypt, or they've taken their inspiration from the gods of Egypt and have basically managed to enslave people and make them believe that they are gods. So what they've done is taken these tropes and these ideas from religion and used them to manipulate people. And it's not hard to do.
Make some good buildings?
Well, I'm sure they made some lovely
buildings we have that are still there. They're, of all the seven ancient wonders, the pyramids of Cheops are the only ones surviving. So
there you go. Could be the Gould's work. You have, you know, just sort of stay with Stargate, just because it has used religious imagery and ideas so much. You have the Asgard, who are these sort of demigod things, and then you have this idea of ascension, sort of moving on to a higher being. I think it's like a non-corporeal, just like consciousness or something like that. So that, you know, that's quite a
that's almost a very Buddhist type of idea.
Buddhist kind of idea, not so much a traditional idea. But interestingly, I think one of the best storylines Stargate ever did was on the Ori. And these Ori are, they sort of worship this idea of origin, which is kind of the religion. And if you don't follow it, then you're evil or bad. So it's very
Do you get banished
binary.
Or... punished.
Well, you can be banished or killed or whatever.
Banished.
And what they do is that the priors of the religion, they're like the priests or the representatives. They have kind of like party tricks that they do to convince people, miracles that they perform.
Like so Hinduism does a bit of that.
Kind of Hinduism, Christianity, they follow this very traditional idea, but their motives and their malevolence are evident right from the start. So it's really interesting to see how that was played out in Stargate. Before we sort of start wrapping up the series, there was just one thing. You can't talk about religion in science fiction without mentioning Scientology. Now, of course, L. Ron Hubbard, who was the founder of the Church of Scientology, is possibly, I don't know, he's responsible for Battlefield Earth. Now, I've never read the book, but I've seen the film. And once you've seen the film, you cannot unsee the film, unfortunately.
There's no going back.
There is no going back. Absolutely. Oh, God, such a terrible film. Now, we could go in and we could have a discussion about, you know, Scientology with the time we have left, but I think South Park summed it up best. This is what they basically said about Scientology in their much vaunted and criticised episode. This evil alien Xenu from 75 million years ago, who trapped a bunch of space folk, froze them, dumped them into Hawaiian volcanoes, trapped their dead souls rising from the flames with his special soul catchers. He then proceeded to brainwash the ghosts and set them loose on Earth.
Wow. I mean, Walt Disney couldn't come up with something better than that.
He really couldn't. And I think, actually, would you follow the religion of Walt Disney or the religion of L. Ron Hubbard?
Mickey Mouse, that's all I can say. Sounds like Mickey Mouse is running that show.
Definitely.
Oops, but that's just my opinion.
So we've been talking about religion in science fiction on Sci-Fi and Scream tonight, and the influence of it, how it appears, how it's placed in science fiction, in both television and literature. We haven't looked a lot at movies, but we did look at 2001 A Space Odyssey, the Stanley Kubrick film. If you're not interested in reading about religion in sci-fi science fiction that takes a particularly positive view on religion, you can always look at something that's a little bit more contradictory. So Robert Sawyer, the author, has written books taking a slightly more atheist view in science fiction. And, of course, Carl Sagan wrote Contact, which has some ideas that sort of question religion and adherence to religion.
I loved Contact.
Yeah, Contact was
fascinating. Pretty imaginative.
Very imaginative. And it does sort of challenge those ideas of religion. Look, any internet search is going to give you sci-fi writers and their religious affiliations. It's really interesting if you sort of type in sci-fi author, religion or religious. There are actually sites that list each
Would
sci-fi author
and
their religion.
Would there be any sci-fi without religion?
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure.
At least another eternal episode.
It is. Something that we really would have to look at a little bit more closely. Before we go on Sci-Fi and Scream, a little bit of news. Bill and Ted 3, are you excited about the possibility of Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter coming back for a third Bill and Ted film?
Aren't they a bit old to be dudes? They're just old dudes now.
They're old dudes now, but...
Is that true? Is it really going to happen?
Well, it may not happen, but apparently they're in talks to develop the third film. So they might be in Zimmer frames, but they're both very keen to return.
Cool.
And Chloe Moretz, who was a bit of a favourite as Hit Girl in Kick-Ass, and I was also in 500 Days of Summer.
She's in Let Me In, which is
the upcoming adaptation of Let the Right One In. She's just been announced as the lead in a live-action version of Emily the Strange. So you're more likely to recognise Emily the Strange as a merchandise character, but in, I think, 2005, they actually started to create...
Who's playing the cat?
...a series of comic books. I don't know. No word on that yet.
Maybe the cat from
Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Oh.
You've been listening to Sci-Fi and Scream.
Yes, but before we go, this is... a special show because, well, it's not just about religion and all that sort of thing, but also it's Kaz's last full-time show.
It is.
On the show. So
I just want to thank everyone for listening to Sci-Fi and Scream and listening to us natter on, me in particular. I will be back for the occasional guest spot, but it's been fantastic. And thank you, Sonia, for being such a great co-host.
That's cool. Thank you.
Sci-Fi and Scream was synthesized and squashed into shape by Sonia, Albert and Kaz. For more information, visit our Facebook page, Sci-Fi and Scream, or check out joy.org.au.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.